foreign currencies and are not enough to provide a living.
Observers say the Saudi-backed Hadi regime has failed to maintain the local currency rate even though it is not facing a siege or economic war like is happening in Sana'a. They say the departure of all the Saudi led coalition forces is the only way to end the humanitarian crisis.
The living situation in the southern regions is bad and the economic deterioration has reached a staggering level. And there are no attempts to stop this collapse by the Saudi-led coalition and its forces in the occupied areas. The free people there must demand the expulsion of the occupation, the cessation of printing the local currency without a cash cover, and the creation of economic alternatives that guarantee the Yemenis a decent life.
On March 2015, the Saudi-led coalition occupied several cities in southern Yemen, including Aden. Since then, these areas have been facing a tragic situation as the prices keep increasing due to the continued depreciation of the currency.
The economic situation in the occupied areas is getting day after day, causing a massive increase in the prices of food and other basic commodities. Observers say the situation is like a famine hitting these areas amid the continued silence of the international community. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, an all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity in sight. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to this could be long-term security guarantees on its Western borders. Марина Картунова, Москва.
Scores of disabled people and their families in the Gaza Strip came out to mark the International Day of Disabled Persons. They held a sit-in in front of the Ministry of Social Development to mark the annual international event. The Palestinian Non-Governmental Organizations Network, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting civilians, including people with disabilities, during the recent war on the Gaza Strip. Last May, Israeli regime forces killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children, during the one-ton bombing of thousands of buildings in the blockaded enclave.
Tens of people became people with disability because of the Israeli offensive on the Gaza Strip. Also, four people with disability were killed in the last offensive. This year, we witnessed deterioration in the socio-economic conditions of people with disability because of the continuous illegal blockade imposed by Israel.
Currently, there are more than 50,000 disabled persons in the blockaded coastal enclave. Thousands of Palestinians in the impoverished territory became disabled during four Israeli wars since 2008. Scores more also suffered permanent disabilities during the 2018 Great March of Return peaceful rallies against Israeli occupation.
An Israeli sniper shot me while I was protesting peacefully during the Great March of Return in 2018 and I became disabled. I want the whole world to know that the Zionist regime is an illegitimate entity that occupies our land and doesn't understand the meaning of peace and only believe in violence and aggression.
During the last offensive, Israeli forces injured over 2,200 Palestinians, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability.
The world community is standing silent for the crimes of Israel. All the time they attack the children, women, and this even disabled people, hospitals, schools. But the problem that the international community is keeping silent, and there is no actions, no measure taken against Israel, and to impose sanction or repression on Israel to stop its aggression against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for disabled Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Experts say thousands of Palestinians in the besieged enclave have suffered from various disabilities in recent years due to Israel's use of internationally banned weapons against the civilian population. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
After a long hunger strike that lasted for 131 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Kaid Al-Fasfous has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released Al-Fasfous from the Israeli hospital of Barzilai, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition because of his hunger strike. He arrived first at his hometown Doura village in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Then he headed to the grave of late President Yasser Arafat in Ramallah. He sent a message to the other prisoners to remain steadfast, reminding them that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
As I did it, my brothers who are on hunger strike will do it. It was not an easy experience at all. Me and the other prisoners went through difficult days and circumstances. We had been beaten, oppressed, and held in solitary confinement, and had been transferred frequently from one prison to another.
Israel arrested Al-Fasfous in October 2020, and it was not his first detention. He was arrested several times in the past, but this time he was held under administrative detention without charge or trial. Last month, the Israeli prison authorities decided to end his administrative detention and release him. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs has appraised Al-Fasfous' victory and appraised his encouragement, describing it as defeating the occupation's authorities, and it hoped that the remaining hunger-striking prisoners, on top of them Hisham Abu Hawash, who has been protesting for 111 days, would also achieve victory.
It's a victory for Al-Fasfous and for the prisoners' movement, as well as for all of us. We praise Al-Fasfous's stance. He refused to retreat despite his deteriorating health condition and bravely insisted on his demand.
Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner, as Israel holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners. Hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Okay, the Fesfus is free today after achieving a tremendous victory following 131 days of his hunger strike. His battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners held under Israel's administrative detention a glimmer of hope to go on with their actions and their fight for justice. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
If the yellow vests march, but the mainstream media doesn't cover it, does it have an effect? In the age of social media, the answer seems to be an unequivocal yes, perhaps much to the anger of so-called legacy media. Since the Yellow Vest started their season two, domestic media has been almost completely absent. But for the eighth consecutive Saturday, they marched nationwide, shut down toll booths, and occupied roundabouts. The Yellow Vests say they don't expect fair treatment from France's private media. Less than 10 billionaires control 90% of all the nation's media, with strict control over an editorial policy which many say is often right-wing.
Starting in June 2019, France's mainstream media simply stopped reporting on the Yellow Vests. However, they continued to march nationwide in major numbers through the two-month general strike that winter and until March 2020, when the coronavirus forced a ban on all public demonstrations.
In Paris, one of the Yellow Vest demonstrations gathered outside of government-owned Radio France's headquarters to denounce the failure of public media journalists to provide fair coverage of the nation's biggest social movement in decades.
We pay our taxes to support public media and we pay to help privately owned media as well, but they both relay the exact same opinions and both exclude them. They both slander any dissenting voices. What we're asking for is that the diversity of opinions be respected, and we're telling these journalists to stop their censorship and propaganda.
The ever-increasing concentration of French media ownership has forced the government to act. This week they quietly authorized a commission to investigate the issue, with results due in early 2022. The conclusions will likely have a lot to say about the true freedom of the French press during the age of Western corporate domination. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
The European Commission's Joint Research Centre says 50 million people in the EU are suffering the effects of so-called energy poverty. It means households are having to prioritise food over heat. EU energy ministers have been meeting in Brussels to assess the crisis.
Since we launched our communication and toolbox on energy prices, 20 member states have taken or announced measures to mitigate the impact on their people and businesses, in particular the most vulnerable.
But that means almost a third of EU governments have not taken any action to protect citizens. Gas and electricity prices are out of control. Civil society organisations are forecasting that energy poverty will be hitting 80 million people in the EU before winter is over. The EU's dysfunctional energy market is currently in a state of flux. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's gas. The European Commission confirms Moscow is fulfilling all of its supply contracts. However, energy storage is a problem in the EU. Supplies were depleted last winter due to unusually cold weather. Then there was huge demand when EU nations began lifting COVID-19 restrictions. Energy experts say the EU could benefit if it improved relations with Russia. The 27-country bloc could also push back against US foreign policy so that new supply chains could be utilised, for example, with respect to Iran, which has enormous energy reserves. EU leaders are divided over how to deal with the crisis, but it's clear there are no quick fixes. The matter will be high on their agenda when they meet here in just under 2 weeks' time for a summit on the 16th of December. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Thank you.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in a country which lectures the world about human rights and the rule of law, the United States is having increasing trouble in protecting its own citizens at home. Gun violence inside of the U.S. is taking the lives of 39,000 Americans every year. And included in that number is a staggering 1,400 young people and children being killed by guns this year. What is going on in the country which usually dictates or tries to how the world lives, the United States of America? We're going to start this off crossing over to Washington, D.C., talking to Colin. Well, tell us about these. They're staggering statistics, really, when we read them and look at them. Tell us what's being said on that side.
Well, that's like you said before, the U.S. is having trouble protecting its own citizens. And when you look at the 29th school shooting that happened very recently in just 2021 alone, it really puts a highlight on some of the problematic situations we have when it comes to gun violence in America, and especially how it's affecting our youth. When you look at the number of people who have been killed, the access to which people can get guns and then take them into public places and then sacrifice people at their whim, at the pull of a trigger, it's really astonishing that more is not being done in the U.S. to control what could be described as out-of-control legislation. And right now, we're not hearing much from politicians because we know we've suffered some of our worst tragedies here in the U.S. without very much political will to change anything holistically or substantively. We did get some bump stock legislation during the Trump administration that disallowed guns to fire repeatedly within a short period of time. But outside of that, we haven't really been seeing anything too substantive. And I think that worries a lot of people here in the U.S. as they talk about whether or not they should be armed in order to defend themselves against those who are already armed. And then you have those who say that they should just move out of the country altogether. What we know is that it's still very much a problem here in the U.S. when dealing with gun violence and gun control, Marzia.
All right. Yeah, you mentioned, Colin, you just talked about exactly what to do, because actually what we have seen, unbelievable as it seems, we've continually seen an increase in the amount of guns in the United States. As you said, those who perhaps didn't have it before then start looking at that maybe they should have it too. And we have seen an unbelievable increase within the last couple of years inside the United States.
Yeah, we've seen an uptick in people getting guns and thinking that this might be the resolution, because there doesn't seem to be any political legislation that will restrict the amount of guns that are coming onto the streets that people are possessing en masse. You have the preppers. Those are people who think that we are just a day or two away from Armageddon at any given time. And so these preppers stockpile weaponry and ammunition for fear that we are approaching a dystopian existence, an apocalyptic type of level event, where there would be anarchy and dissolution of the government, and that there would be people who would only be left up to their own devices to defend themselves and their family. And
thanks
so you have these
thanks
people
so much, Colin. Sorry to interrupt you. We're just so limited in time. I appreciate you being with us. SOBI's correspondent, Colin Campbell, out of Washington, D.C. Well, let me welcome my guests to this program. Editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris, out of Phoenix, Arizona. And peace advocate, Reverend Graylin Hagler, out of Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Phoenix and with Mike. Now, Mike, the figures are staggering. Why do we continue to see an increase in the number of people killed by guns inside of the country, something that I was just talking to our correspondent about?
Oh, that's an easy answer, because we have an increasing drug problem. Most of the gun violence in this country is directly linked to the problem of illegal drugs in this country. We've had an uptick in heroin, fentanyl, opioids, methamphetamine, all this stuff. And really what this boils down to is turf wars over who gets to control the drug traffic in the cities. That's really where the problems take place. It's directly tied to the drug problem. And if you would attack the real issue of the drug issue, you would find that gun violence would decrease exponentially. So that's the simple answer. That's it. That's the
discussion. Then, Mike, if that's the simple answer, then I guess an extension then of that question would be, so if the drug issue, as you say, is the problem, so why isn't that prioritized? Why wouldn't it be prioritized then to deal with the drug issue inside of the United States?
Well, because we are the best politicians money can buy, and nobody has more money than the drug cartels. Their influence is far and wide. They have the saying down here in Arizona that we can give you silver or we can give you lead. And so they either pay off the politicians or they eliminate them. That's really what happens on a major scale here. And I want to point out to everyone that look at Australia. You want to see what happens to a disarmed people? You have a tyrannical government come in and impose their will upon them, enforce vaccinations, putting people in internment camps. That's what happens when you're unarmed. Then you look at Switzerland, where it is a requirement that every citizen have a firearm in their house and be prepared to defend the country. Switzerland's never been invaded. So our model here is not perfect, but we're fighting the wrong war. And the war to fight is to eliminate the drug problem, and that will dramatically reduce the problem of gun violence in this country.
Well, that's interesting what you've just said when you brought in the analogy of Australia. I mean, so then you would be seen to say, what you're seen to say is basically that the Aussies right now should be taking up arms against the government. So tell me exactly, what are you saying in the middle of this? What would you like to see? The ideal situation in the United States would be what?
Well, I would like to see the drug problem addressed in a open and honest and aggressive manner, to where we stopped the, a week ago, 18,000 pounds of fentanyl and methamphetamine came across the border, was seized by Border Patrol. 18,000 pounds of methamphetamine and fentanyl. That's a lot. We've got a drug problem in here that is raging out of control, and we need to get a handle on it, and we need to eliminate the drug issue and stop that as a viable industry here within the U.S.
Okay.
Cut the cartels off, starve them to death.
All
and
right.
That really is the nexus of the problem.
All right. That's interesting, Mike, that you said that. I mean, I spent a lot of times in inner cities and documentaries and talking to people that actually told me about the government, as a matter of fact, dropping drugs off in those areas. But another subject, let me get in Reverend Hagler. Thank you so much, Reverend Hagler. Good to see you. Your take on this whole situation of what's going on. We have 1,400 kids being killed in the United States every year from guns. Now, our previous guest, Mike in Phoenix, said that basically it's because of the drug problem that we have in the cities, and that's where the gun violence is taking place. Your assessment, sir?
Well, it's something much deeper than that. I mean, I think that we can reach for sort of what is low-hanging fruit and claim it's drugs or this or that. But the reality is that gun culture in the United States of America has been of a very pernicious nature. As somebody has said in the past, it is as American as apple pie. The idea of guns and the use of guns to take land, to oppress people, to enslave people, to exterminate Native folks. There's an obsession with guns that exists in this country. There is an obsession with guns, and guns go with the Bible. And that's been the whole case of America. So there's something about the very DNA of the country that makes it sick. It makes it sick, and everything is predicated upon a gun. Every solution is predicated upon a gun. But it's much deeper than that. If you want to deal with the drug problem, you got to deal with, for example, you got to deal with what recovery looks like, how you treat people who are addicted, And that's the only way you begin to take away the addiction in the country. But it's not really built upon guns and a foreign trade. It's built upon this obsession of guns, that if you got a gun, you believe that you can take whatever you want to take, and you have a right to it by the firepower of a gun. A gun is very much an American obsession.
Well, staying with you, Reverend Hagler, Mike said that basically he compared it to situations happening in Australia right now, that basically he called it a tyrannical government that's taking place, that exists now in Australia, taking the rights of people. So your assessment of what this means, or what this perspective means inside of the United States, because we do have a lot of people feeling just like Mike.
Well, that's, again, that's that obsession, that fear that exists. When folks came in so-called New World, they had a fear of indigenous people. So they, with the gun and gunpowder, they began to exterminate nations of indigenous people in this country. There's always a fear that exists, and somehow fear laced with guns create a situation that is explosive and deadly. And that has been the history that has existed from the birth of this country.
Okay.
And you know, and I mean, just look at it, the idea of the Wild West in the United States, built upon gun. Who was the fastest gun? Who had the most guns? Who could control the most of the land through guns? Also, how do you control people you enslave through guns? Guns are of a very oppressive nature, and it exists to continue to prop up a white supremacist paradigm in this country.
Okay, let me get Mike back in on this. Mike, does this whole scenario have anything to do with the profits that are accrued by the gun industry? Do you see any correlation whatsoever?
No, I really don't. The drug industry is far more profitable. And to the other guest point, the Reverend there, the Romans enslaved people, but they didn't have guns. I don't miss the point. I mean, a weapon is a weapon, whether it's a gun or a baseball bat or an automobile, like we saw up in Wisconsin last week, where that deranged fellow from BLM drove his car through a Christmas parade. I mean, if the person is motivated, they don't need a gun to kill people. They can kill people with any number of things. It's the intention of the individual to cause harm. It's not the inanimate object itself.
But at the same time, and, Mike, you're saying that. But when we look at the statistics, I mean, 39,000 people being killed by these guns, it's major. You say that it could be a baseball bat, it could be whatever, obviously, it's a little bit easier to fire that weapon than to beat a person to death with a bat, and less likely to happen. So, I mean, isn't this a matter of not prioritizing the lives and the safety of the people of the United States?
No, and we didn't have a gun violence problem in this country, and so we started having a drug problem. And if you want to use statistics, why don't we look at the number of deaths caused by automobiles? We're going to get rid of automobiles as well? I mean, come on. Let's do the math here. What you've got is turf wars going on in the city to control the drug traffic. Who's going to get the revenue? That's where the majority of the gun violence occurs. It's not occurring in rural America, where the density of ownership is 10 times greater per capita in rural America than it is in the inner cities. And there's not a gun problem out there. There's not a violence problem out there. Like I said, this is directly correlated to the drug issue. End of discussion. There is no debating this.
Okay. Let me cross back over to Washington. And Reverend Hagler, when we look at these 1,400 kids, when we see the statistics being killed in 1 year, I mean, it sounds like a country that is actually at war. I mean, not a country with no foreign invaders, not a country set to be the greatest power in the world, because if you say that you can help solve the problems of other countries on the other side of the world, at least that's what it says, why can't you solve the problems inside of your own country?
Let me just make a comment on what the other person just said. There was always a gun problem in the United States of America. Guns enslaved people. Guns exterminated, practiced genocide on indigenous people. Guns have always been a part of the diet in the United States of America, a diet of conquest and a diet of death. And that is the end of the debate, as you said. There's no debate about it. There's no debate about that. When Aubrey was killed in Georgia, it was because of a gun. He was jogging harmless, unarmed through a neighborhood. And it was folks with guns that decided to gun him down because he did not belong there in terms of their estimation. And it gets me that all these folks who want to characterize and protect gun ownership, they're going to protect assault weapons, and then they're going to turn around and still try to justify when kids are gunned down for going to school, for going to high school or elementary school. What kind of moral bankruptcy is that? We have a moral bankruptcy in this country. We have a refusal to stand up and say enough is enough, and that nobody really should have an assault weapon in a so-called civilized society, a weapon that you use to go to war with. Clearly, there's a whole lot of misguided type of logic that comes out of mouths, and our guest here is no different. Illogical, makes illogical arguments.
Well, Mike, 3 million children are directly exposed to gun violence in the United States each year, either being killed or wounded and traumatized. What does that mean to you and the effect that it has on the overall society?
Well, it's a horrible loss. We're losing the better part of a generation. And that is a shame. These are innocent children who don't deserve to die. And you know, looking at the topical cause and blaming it on inanimate objects, again, is not. It's the intention of the person who is wielding that object, whether it's a baseball bat or an automobile or a gun. They can all kill people, and they all do, as we witnessed last week in Wisconsin when that guy drove his SUV through the crowd and killed 6 people, injured 39 others. You know, so evil intention is what it is. And it's lack of regard for other people. When these drug dealers are having a shootout with their rival gangs, they don't care who's in the way. They just care about killing the other guy. And they use the old spray and pray, and where the poorly targeted bullets go, and it kills innocents. And this is a shame. I agree with the Reverend here. He is correct that this is a tragedy in America. And yes, it does need to be addressed. I'm not arguing that fact. But I think that the root cause on this, again, I will say, is the drug problem. Your guests make some points, but they're not germane here. Look at the statistics from the 1950s and the 1960s, before the drug problem began to increase in this country. And as the drug problem has increased, gun violence has also increased.
Well, let me just jump in here, Mike, because I'm looking at the statistics. Sorry to interrupt you. I'm looking at the statistics right now that have come out. And out of the gun deaths, 61% of them are suicide. 61%. So what do you think? I mean, if those guns weren't around, there's a big gap, let me say, between the suicide and then the next form of suicide from gun violence and the next form of suicide. So if 61% of the gun violence actually are suicides, what does that say? Does that put up a red flag for you that perhaps we shouldn't have that many guns in the country?
Well, if it wasn't the guns, it would be some other means. People have been overdosing on drugs for a long time. They can drown themselves, they can jump off of buildings, they can jump off of bridges. When people are determined to commit suicide, they will commit suicide. I will grant you, yes, the suicides are a tragedy, and gun suicides are probably the most prevalent methodology of suicide because it is the easiest, so to speak. But that doesn't mean that people who commit suicide are not harming anyone else. So who are they committing violence against?
Against themselves. I mean, against themselves, Mike. I mean, isn't one life important? So, I mean, if the majority of gun violence has said that it's suicide, and there's a big gap between guns being responsible for suicide and the next form being suffocation, there is like half of the amount of those who are killing themselves by suffocation compared to guns. So you're saying they're not harming anyone, but they are harming themselves. Isn't one life worth?
Yeah, don't we all have the choice to choose our method of death? I mean, that's sort of a personal decision here. And that's something that if someone wants to take their own life, no one is going to stop them if they're determined, whether there's a gun around or not.
Okay.
I mean, the Romans used to fall on their swords as a way of committing suicide. So
okay.
I don't think that suicide counts as a gun violence issue. They're not harming anyone else. They're merely taking their own life at their own request. I mean, there's no innocents who are out there being killed with this.
Let me switch over to, I'm so sorry, but we're almost out of time. Let me cross back over to D.C. Reverend Agler. We're talking about kids. We're talking about kids here and having that access to guns and that it makes them more likely to kill themselves. I mean, obviously, just with the two of you on this program, we can see the schism, the divide that is taking place in the United States. What is key here? What is it going to take to try to resolve this problem and to try to keep tens and thousands of Americans alive instead of just looking the other way and letting them die like this?
You know, but listen to your statistic and listen to your guess, because one of the things in terms of your statistic points out, particularly in terms of suicide, 61% of guns, gun deaths are suicide. It's because of the availability of guns, the availability of guns. The fact is that just about anybody under the sun, just like what happened the other day up in Michigan, can get access to a gun. And if you are hell-bent on using it, you're going to use it. If you're in an argument and there's emotions running high and a gun is available, you're going to use it. The fact is the availability of guns is the problem in society. A police chief out of New Haven, Connecticut, years ago.
30 seconds, sir. 30 seconds.
Okay, also wrote a paper and basically documented that when gun production went down, the death rate went down. When gun production goes up, the death rate goes up. It's all built upon the availability of guns.
Okay, and I'm so sorry because I would really actually love to continue this conversation with both of you perhaps another time. I appreciate you being with us. Out of Phoenix, Arizona, I'm editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris, and out of D.C., peace advocate Reverend Raylan Hagler. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Your micron variant contains a new pattern of mutations to its spike protein. These changes could disrupt the ability of some, but probably not all, of the antibodies induced by the current vaccines to bind to the spike protein. If that happens, the vaccines could be less effective at preventing people from getting infected by and transmitting the Omicron variant. We now present you an article written by Deborah Fuller, Professor of Microbiology at the School of Medicine, University of Washington. The piece is titled, How Soon Will Omicron Vaccines Be Ready? If the Omicron variant of the coronavirus is different enough from the original variant, it's possible that existing vaccines won't be as effective as they have been. If so, it's likely that companies will need to update their vaccines. Deborah Fuller is a microbiologist who has been studying mRNA and DNA vaccines for over two decades. Here she explains why vaccines might need to be updated and what that process would entail. 1. Why might vaccines need to be updated? Basically, it's a question of whether a virus has changed enough so that antibodies created by the original vaccine are no longer able to recognize and fend off the new mutated variant. Coronaviruses use spike proteins to attach to ACE2 receptors on the surface of human cells and infect them. All mRNA COVID-19 vaccines work by giving instructions in the form of mRNA that directs cells to make a harmless version of the spike protein. This spike protein then induces the human body to produce antibodies. If a person is then ever exposed to the coronavirus, these antibodies bind to the coronavirus's spike protein and thus interfere with its ability to infect the person's cells. The Omicron variant contains a new pattern of mutations to its spike protein. These changes could disrupt the ability of some, but probably not all, of the antibodies induced by the current vaccines to bind to the spike protein. If that happens, the vaccines could be less effective at preventing people from getting infected by and transmitting the Omicron variant. How would a new vaccine be different? Existing mRNA vaccines, like those made by Moderna or Pfizer, encode for a spike protein from the original strain of coronavirus. In a new or updated vaccine, the mRNA instructions would encode for the Omicron spike protein. By swapping out the genetic code of the original spike protein for the one from this new variant, a new vaccine would induce antibodies that more effectively bind to the Omicron virus and prevent it from infecting cells. People already vaccinated or previously exposed to COVID-19 would likely need only a single booster dose of a new vaccine to be protected not only from the new strain, but also other strains that may be still in circulation. If Omicron emerges as a dominant strain over Delta, then those who are unvaccinated would only need to receive 2 to 3 doses of the updated vaccine. If Delta and Omicron are both in circulation, people would likely get a combination of the current and updated vaccines. 3. How do scientists update a vaccine? To make an updated mRNA vaccine, you need two ingredients: the genetic sequence of the spike protein from a new variant of concern, and a DNA template that would be used to build the mRNA. In most organisms, DNA provides the instructions for making mRNA. Since researchers have already published the genetic code for the Omicron spike protein, all that's left to do is make a DNA template for the spike protein that will be used to produce the mRNA part of new vaccines. To do this, researchers mix DNA templates with synthetic enzymes and form molecular building blocks that make mRNA. That is G, A, U, and C for short. The enzymes then build an mRNA copy of the DNA template, a process called transcription. Using this process, it only takes minutes to produce a batch of mRNA for vaccines. Researchers then place the mRNA transcripts within fatty nanoparticles that protect the instruction until they are safely delivered into cells in your arm. And four, how long until a new vaccine might be ready? It takes only 3 days to generate the DNA template needed to make a new mRNA vaccine. Then it would take about a week to produce sufficient doses of the mRNA vaccine for testing in the laboratory, and another 6 weeks to perform the preclinical tests on human cells in test tubes to make sure a new vaccine works as it should. So within 52 days, scientists could have an updated mRNA vaccine ready to plug into the manufacturing process and begin producing doses for a human clinical trial. The trial would likely require at least another few weeks for a total of around 100 days to update and test a new vaccine. While that trial is going on, manufacturers could start switching their current process to making a new vaccine. Ideally, once the clinical trial is complete, and if the vaccine gets authorized and approved, a company could immediately start rolling out doses of a new vaccine. 5. Does an updated vaccine need full clinical trials? It's currently not clear how much clinical data would be required to get FDA approval or authorization for an updated COVID-19 vaccine. However, all the ingredients would be the same in a new vaccine. The only difference would be a few lines of genetic code that would ever so slightly change the shape of the spike protein. From a safety perspective, an updated vaccine is essentially identical to the already tested vaccines. Because of these similarities, clinically testing may not need to be as extensive as what was needed for the first generation COVID-19 vaccines. At a minimum, clinical trials for updated vaccines would likely require safety testing and confirmation that an updated vaccine induces antibody level on par with the response of the original vaccine against the original beta and delta strains. If these are the only requirements, then researchers would enroll only hundreds, not tens of thousands of people to obtain the clinical data needed. One important thing to note is that if vaccine manufacturers decide to update their vaccines for the Omicron variant, it wouldn't be the first time making this kind of change. A previous variant, the B1351, emerged in October of 2020 and was sufficiently resistant to then-current vaccines to warrant updating them. Manufacturers quickly responded to the potential threat by developing an updated mRNA vaccine to match this variant and performed clinical trials to test the new vaccine. Fortunately, this variant did not become the dominant strain. But if it had, vaccine manufacturers would have been ready to roll out an updated vaccine. If it turns out that Omicron, or any future variant for that matter, warrants a new vaccine, companies have already completed the dress rehearsals and are ready to meet the challenge.
Good morning. comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.